But it was all that I could do to keep from crying.
Well, you know who had his ashes spread at home plate?
The dude that did the Go Cubs Go song.
Yeah,
wasn't his name Goodman?
Steve Goodman.
Go Cubs Go! Go Cubs Go!
You know what else he wrote?
He wrote the perfect country and western song, and then he sent it to either Waylon Jennings or one of those guys.
Well, a friend of mine named Steve Goodman wrote that song, and he told me it was the perfect country and western song.
They read it, and they said, this is almost perfect, but you didn't mention anything about mama or prison.
Because he hadn't said anything at all about mama.
Or train.
Or train.
Or pickup trucks.
Or trucks.
So then Goodman allegedly wrote the next verse, which was, it was raining the day my mama got out of prison.
The day my mom got out of prison.
Hello and welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. Somehow he's Thomas Hall on the board here. Made it on time, I guess, in somebody's world. SP Futures up 15, NASDAQ Futures up 46. We have a rally going today, had a big rally, huge rally yesterday. We had gold going down this morning, we got oil going, copper going up, we got all kinds of stuff happening. Kevin, how are you?
Good. How are you doing today, Tom?
I'm doing all right. Every time I hear that intro, it makes me think about people who get their get cremated and their ashes scattered.
Really? What, okay. What's the connection?
The connection is Steve Goodman also wrote, well, he wrote Go Cubs Go, but he also wrote The Train They Call the City New Orleans, mm-hmm. which is a very complicated, long song. I mean, I don't know how anybody can sing that thing. I mean, you really, it's not like it's a four-verser. And, but when he died young, I think of cancer, not positive on that, but pretty sure, he was cremated and his ashes were spread at home plate at Wrigley Field. And then 2 years later, they totally tore up the field, put in a whole new field. So now he's like in a dumpster thing somewhere, which I don't think is so hot. Just saying.
They probably hauled off the dirt, and he's now sod in some suburban neighborhood.
I think he's at the bottom of one of those big, huge ditches they throw garbage. Just saying.
It's symbolic, Chief. The fact was he was there at the time.
Just saying. I mean, I think, if you get your spot, you're better off. Anyway, so Thomas has got a big dress-up thing tonight, although he did not dress up for the show. What do you make of that, Kevin?
I would expect it. I kind of always envisioned Thomas in a tuxedo as he produced the show.
Yeah, just saying.
Well, I could do it.
Yeah, he could do it. He could do something. Well, we got Bitcoin mating.
Cleans up pretty well. Is that what you're saying?
I don't know about that, but I just mentioned no shrimp in the no shrimp in the pocket. You know, like Dan Aykroyd. Hey, I was doing a little research today on bizarre stuff, which is what I do, I guess. As it looks like Bitcoin. Let me get the price on Bitcoin here. Crypto, it's up $1,600 to $59,000. Again, this thing is worth zero. In my mind, because it's not backed by anything. But I was sort of reeling here. Talk about
sort of like the dollar, huh?
Yeah. So, well, that's everybody's sort of thing. But you know what? That's not true. I mean, first of all, I know that's the direction the dollar is going. I can't argue that with anybody.
Yeah, I actually heard somebody on the radio yesterday mention Weimar Republic.
Yeah.
Well, man, if somebody's been listening.
Yeah. So But the dollar still is backed by the gold and all the assets the U.S. government has, which are significant, right? I mean, the idea of running the dollar up 10% a year or whatever the hell they're doing, or 20% or 40% in the last 2 years, is unconscionable in my mind. But the simple fact is, it's backed by one hell of a lot more than Bitcoin. I'm just saying, I don't think Bitcoin has any aircraft carriers, they don't have any planes, they don't have any roads, they don't have any bridges, do they? Or do they? Just saying.
Oh, I'm sure they have plenty of infrastructure. I don't know. They have algorithms.
How's yeah, that? They must have. But here's an interesting thing. I'm reading about the tulip mania, which is sort of hard to read about, really, because there's a person who wrote a book, Mackay, about the madness of crowds, talking about the tulip mania. And in the 80s, a bunch of people did a whole bunch of research and sort of debunked some of that. But but at some point, I don't think it's deniable that the price of a tulip was worth like, know, 2 tons of beer and, you know, like 12 acres of land. It was, I mean, it got absolutely crazy. But what's interesting is the, there's a deal here where at some point, a lot of this stuff, they, in the progression, the reason why I'm saying this is Bitcoin is up today because the Federal Reserve has decided to not block an ETF, a Bitcoin ETF, or a, whatever you want to call it. I don't know if it's all Bitcoin, but probably a blend of them, which means now it's going to be on an exchange, which it kind of was in the board of trade before. So if you look at the history of the tulip, first it was just people buying and selling it. Then it became on an exchange or a bunch of exchanges, and then it became marginable, and then it crashed. That's kind of the progression. We're marginal being, you get to borrow money to buy the thing. And it's one thing if somebody actually plunks down $59,000 for Bitcoin, I guess it's their business. But if they can borrow half of it from somebody else, and all people do this all around the country, then it sort of becomes everybody's business. Because now other people are on the hook. You know, your deposit at your bank or whatever it is a little less sacred than it was before, I would think. But that's just me. And you find that just about every big crash in a stock market, anywhere it is almost always, coincidental to like a margin record, a margin borrowing record. No. Because otherwise you're not forced to sell on the way down if you didn't borrow. Correct? But this is what's very interesting, that at some point here, the stuff was never delivered because, and it says here, and this is fascinating, because they had tulip futures, right? So there were people that essentially bought the tulip futures at certain prices, and then which were way high, and then of course you buy and sell futures like you do corn and do like the S&P futures, you know, NASDAQ futures, like corn, wheat, so forth. We've been doing this here forever, but it didn't start here. It started, you know, other places like here in the tulips. But get a load of this. On October 24th, 1637, the self-regulating Guild of Dutch Florists. What in the hell do you think that is? Guild of Dutch Florists. In a decision that was later ratified by the Dutch Parliament, announced that all futures contracts written after November 30th, 1636, and before the reopening of the cash market in the early spring, were to be interpreted as option contracts. They did this by simply relieving the futures buyers of the obligation to buy the future tulips, forcing them merely to compensate the sellers with a small fixed percentage of the contract price. I've never heard of that before. That is unreal. That they essentially ixnayed the contract and said, okay, make it like an option, and instead of buying corn at $14 a bushel, and now it's trading, you know, $4. Just pay the guy like a buck and a half and you're good to go. Like if you would have bought the 14 calls for a buck and a half. The exact same transaction. That is absolutely, I wonder if that's going to happen again someday. Maybe with these things.
Well, probably. We're very prone to repeating repeating history. So, yeah, you know, that could well be true. I want to go back to Ixnay though, it being a financial term now, huh?
Yeah. Well, it's a good one.
Is that guild as real as...
We need to somehow ingrain that into financial media or something.
Well, if we hear it today, anywhere else on CNBC...
Daily Ixnay.
Once in a while we say something on the show, not always me, but one of the listeners, and you pick it up later on CNBC, so somebody somewhere is listening. Because they didn't think of it, I don't think.
Chief, I was going to ask you, is that guild as real as the Guild of Cicero meat butchers?
Well, they used to have... Well, guild was essentially... Well, it was a trade organization, right, Kevin?
Mm-hmm.
And there's, are there?
Yeah, it's just a word. It's a word that's fallen into relative disuse.
But I mean, do we have? We still have trade. You know this more than me. I mean, do all the grocery stores, independent grocery stores in Indiana, have some sort of a organization or not? I mean, I don't know.
Well, first of all, what independent grocery stores are we talking about?
Well, I mean,
there just aren't very many of them anymore.
Well,
there are some. You will find the occasional Hardings, you know, which is kind of a loose conglomeration. It's a brand name, but it's kind of this loose. It's like the old IGA.
I was going to say, Chief, they're called Walmart now.
Yeah.
I think that's the name of the local markets.
Well, I mean, just as a little bit of history, and I don't know the whole portion of it, but there, in when I grew up in Evergreen Park, there were probably six or seven smaller independent grocers in the hood. When I say in the hood, within 2 miles of our house. But 2 miles in Evergreen Park was, you know, you drove. It wasn't like you were 2 miles in downtown. But I would say every one of them had, they were in parts of the Independent Grocers Association, which essentially was a trade group that I think did common buying and everything, right, Kevin? So they, when they put out an advertising thing, like you go into any other store and there's the advertising sheet, they all, like if you had, you know, peppers on sale, they all had peppers on sale. So they obviously made a common buy on peppers or something. Do you think they're even still around? I mean, because it was a way for those guys.
I don't know. I haven't seen that IGA brand in, I don't know how long.
I haven't either. I mean, because they essentially banded together to be bigger buyers in a way to compete with the Jewels and those kinds of places. And I think
it was essentially a buying co-op.
Yeah. And there was one in Evergreen Park, IGA. I used to get all my meat there and stuff and chicken. They had the best stuff. But this is a perfect example of what's going on, I think, with some of these smaller places. Is there was a guy who ran the place and made a very nice living. And the people in the neighborhood, especially people who didn't have cars, he was like their bank. He cashed all their checks, all that stuff. And this guy, Kevin, the store was about as big as a produce section of a Jewel, and I would bet you that he had more products in there than the Jewel. I mean, they had every conceivable thing. If somebody in the neighborhood wanted it, there'd be three bottles of that brand of ketchup on it. But, I mean, they were stacked to the ceiling and just bought everything. But he is, as soon as he retired, it closed. I mean, he had no family that wanted to do that every day. And he had a couple of butchers. They retired and that was it. You know, just gone. But I'm sure it was a living for him and his family and them. And, you know, a lot of this small businesses being gone is just nobody wants to run them. I mean, what's going to happen when somebody's, this is probably not politically correct, it's going to happen when a few of these Greek guys croak. Their kids don't want to run these restaurants. Right? I mean, they're just all going to be a chain.
No, I would disagree, Chief, especially in the Chicago area. Right here in Greektown? You don't think?
You know how many restaurants are in Greektown? Two.
Four?
Two. Two or three?
No, I think you need to reevaluate that.
The one across the street from the Greek Islands closed.
Athens or whatever it was?
There's a place that has the balcony. They're open. There's a place that has the little seating area in front. They're open, and the Greek Isles open. Everything else is closed. I just drove down there 2 weeks ago, and I was appalled by nothing being there. I'm talking about a place like the Hollywood Grill and those kinds of places. When that guy dies, I guarantee his kids are not going to run that place.
Well, maybe not his kids, but I'm sure there's going to be someone that's going to be put in
place.
Just
saying, they're closing all over the place.
Yeah, I think Mr. James is gone. I mean, that's, you know, that was one of my favorites.
95th Street, the Parthenon is gone.
Mr. James was up at, Cicero and Irving, that area. And that was always after a long night out, where you could go, you know, wander in there at 3 or 4 in the morning and order a stack of pancakes and a bottle of beer.
So that's interesting to me, actually. Do you think possibly because of the requirements of knowing the recipes as opposed to, like, a Gene and Jude's, right? A Gene and Jude's is never going to close. There's always going to be someone that runs that.
We'll see. Always is a long time. I'm saying that the people who run these places, a lot of the places here in Chicago that have closed, Greek restaurants now, but I'm going to say Jay's Potato Chips, Canfield's, Romano Beverages, the places that I know about, even Wrigley's for that matter, when those places, all of a sudden they get to the point where the guy who's the man either retires and it gets split up to his kids, and all of a sudden somebody makes a bid for the place, and the kids say, wait a minute, I get how many $1 million, or I watch your brother run the place, let's take the $1 million. It's exactly what happened to Romano Beverage. It's what happened to Canfield's. What happened to Jay's.
Yeah, and that's true of a lot of businesses. Even, you know, you might even get the second generation in there. It's the third generation that wants to sell.
Oh yeah.
It just gets harder and harder as you go. And look, a lot of it is that people, you know, they start out with entrepreneurs, you know, very much the self-made type of person who starts a business, and you know, the next generation grows up in the business, so that's, it's pretty normal being part of it. But the generation after that has reaped all the benefits, has, is well educated, and really able to spread the wings into different kinds of careers. And so, yeah, it, it, they just normally fall by the wayside. You know, it's usually the you know, any founded business, there's kind of a progression from the founder to related to the founder to knows the founder to so far removed from the founder that you don't know anything, that, you know, there's no legacy anymore.
But I'm going to, I'll lob this one out here. I'm not even in a grumpy mood, but I'll lob this one out there. I watched how, well, when Audrey's uncle ran Ed Jansen Oldsmobile, and even his son, Eddie, our cousin, who's obviously still with us. I'm going to say this, Kevin. 5% of the population wants to work that hard with that kind of responsibility. The normal person, most of the people that I know, their kids are in high school, thinking about college, all those kinds of things. They've never once had a job, ever. They don't want to work that hard. I mean, there is no history of working anywhere there. I'm not saying they're bad people at all. I mean, one of my good buddies, his son is, he's like a junior now, he'll be a senior next year. And he's talking about going to Michigan State for this 3-week seminar and going somewhere else, and he's doing the best for him. And I said, when are you going to try the J word? When's the kid going to get a job? What do you mean? I'd much rather have him work at, go to Michigan State for 3 weeks for the seminar, then what's he going to learn, like slugging hamburgers? He said he's going to learn how to do something. He's learned how to get along with other people. He's going to learn how to
show up on time, work in teams.
Yeah, all the stuff that people supposed to.
All of those kinds of things that are really what employers are saying they need.
But it's not just that. You need to know that stuff just generally, not because an employer wants it. You need it for yourself. Education is for you. Right? I mean, you need to know how to deal with people. You need to know how to get along. If there's 20 people there, you're not going to get along with all 20 of them. Yet you have to learn to work with the ones that you don't necessarily want to have a beer with, right? That's all part of the of being an adult.
Yeah, you got to learn how to do a little research and find out something for yourself.
I'll bet you the guy at
there's just so much there that is, you know, that we. From an education standpoint, people refer to it as soft skills. I tend to think of it as employability skills, but you're right, they are life skills.
SP Futures up 17, NASDAQ Futures up 55. When we come back, Kevin's going to dissect the fact that the president says that we should try working 24/7, how we're all saved, and how the market's up, like God knows how much, since Joe Biden fixed the supply chain problem. Be right back, Stocks and Jocks.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to gauge the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other decision. And Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with relevant trade ideas, and equips you with cutting-edge tactics you don't already know. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on pursuing life, luxury, and happiness through sports, fitness, travel, food, spirits, music, and a whole lot more. Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. Confused about investing these days? I suspect you are not alone. Investing was never easy, although at times it may have seemed so. I think one reason behind the current concern, although maybe not explained as such, is how the fluctuation in the American dollar and the associated politics is affecting your investments and your wealth. It may not be enough to make some money in your investments. You may need now to make enough to exceed the amount that your leadership is depreciating the value of the dollars you've worked your whole life to accumulate. That same leadership has seen fit to maneuver risk-free interest rates to near zero. Providing positive risk-averse returns in a zero-interest and declining real wealth environment is by far the toughest assignment I've ever had in my years as a money manager. I'm sure that a lot of you have heard that one way to possibly deal with this problem is to invest in so-called hard currencies like silver and gold, the idea being that they will retain their relative value in the face of devaluation of paper currencies like the dollar. To be honest, I have never been a gold bug. I've always had faith that having enough dollars and a good investment strategy was good enough. Now I'm not so sure. But I do know that if I did invest in gold or silver, I'd want to do it in the same manner as we do with PTI for investments in the market, with defined risk. If you feel the need to invest in gold or silver, we can do it using the same strategies that we use for our protected index program. No matter what you invest in, we feel that you need to know and control your risk. Find us at PTISecurities.com. That's PTISecurities.com.
Is your business being challenged by the complexities surrounding healthcare reform or other matters related to human resources management? If so, then Cognos HR can help. A longtime friend and contributor to the Stocks and Jocks radio program, Cognos HR provides its clients with a perfect blend of strategic consulting and day-to-day HR management to drive overall improvement in business performance. Companies that join the Cognos HR family are better able to manage healthcare costs, enhance benefit offerings, and improve employee satisfaction by leveraging our access to Fortune 500 benefits. Our innovative onboarding and payroll technology, along with our constant attention to detail, enables us to provide the highest level of quality service to our clients. Now, your time and energy can be focused on generating business and increasing your bottom line. We'll take care of the rest. For more information, call us at 630-401-8810 or search us on the web at CognosHR.com. Cognos HR, innovation in human resources. Licensed in Illinois and Arizona.
Stocks, jocks,
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now.
Hello and welcome to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Allen, Mr. Thomas Hall on the board. S&P futures up 18, NASDAQ futures up 57. I'm dying to see what Thomas can look like in all the clothes he brought, but all I'm getting is the hoodie look. Just saying.
Chief, it's a suit. You've seen me in suits many times.
Does that mean I'm supposed to say I think you have many suits?
I have at least two.
Well, there you go. That's pretty good.
Because we talked in plurals, right?
Yeah,
so there's at least two.
Well, in COVID time, that's quite a few, I'd say. There's people. Anyway,
yeah, I don't think I have two at the moment.
I don't think I do either. I get a lot of people have suits that don't fit after the COVID.
Well, I didn't have suits that fit for a long time either. But probably for the opposite reason.
Yes, well. Thomas has turned into a boxer for us. Anyway, S&P futures up 18, NASDAQ futures up 58. We've got this huge kind of rally going on here, and this is all after the inflation numbers this week, which everybody says were spectacular, and in fact, I think they're pretty darn hot, 5.4 and 8.4 on the PPI. My Dow futures up 155. Over in Asia, we've got the Nikkei up 517. That's 1.8%. Shanghai up 14.4%. Hang Seng up 368. Now, they've been closed for a couple days. Up 1.5%. Over in Europe, we've got the DAX up 51.3%. FTSE up 14.2%. CAC around up 30.46%. As a way of review, yesterday had a huge rally. Dow is up 534. S&P up 74. That's 1.7%. That's a big move. It's got to be one of the biggest moves this year, if not the biggest. NASDAQ up 251, 1.7. Bonds, 10 years, 1.54. The Bund is minus 0.18, and Japan positive 0.08, so pretty much right where they've been. Although the 10-year did get over 1.6 last week and has come back down for the last few days, not exactly sure why. Oil up 78 cents, 82.09. Brent up 88 cents, 84.88. NASDAQ up, natural gas, sorry, up 3 cents, 5.71. Arbob up a penny to 2.45. We've got gold down this morning, down 14.80. 17.83, so obviously under 1,800. Silver down 14 cents, 23.33. Copper up 9 cents, 4.73. And we've got the Bitcoin, like I said earlier, up 1,700 because it looks like they're going to make an ETF out of it. 59,381. Thomas, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports, and I just can't imagine how a controversial call to end a game goes the Dodgers' way. I'm stunned.
It was an awful call. But anyways, Chief, it is now 6:37 here in the Chicagoland area. Our weather today looks like a standard Chicago fall day as it is now 60 degrees. We will reach a high of 62. There is a slight chance of rain and we will hit a low of about 45. Our Phoenix listeners, you are currently at 56 degrees. They will reach a high of 86. and clear for most of the day, so it looks like a standard Phoenix fall day, if that's even a thing. Chief, the Chicago traffic currently stands as this. There is a report of a new lane configuration in the Stevenson inbound at Route 83. Looks like an overnight crew split the two lanes, and the two left lanes are causing a bit of a delay to start the ride into the Chicago downtown area. There is also a multi-vehicle crash that was on the Kennedy outbound near Canfield. Is blocking two lanes. So there's backup that goes all the way back before Harlem. Chief, in sports, as you already alluded to, the Los Angeles Dodgers do advance as a 1-2-1, a bad or controversial check third call strike was the end of the game, and the Dodgers will now face the Atlanta Braves in the next round. In Thursday night football, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers were able to secure a win 28-22. Tom Brady and crew were looking pretty solid. The Bears do have a concern with their running back because he is on a COVID list, and his status for this game coming up against the Green Bay Packers is in doubt. Chief.
Well, speaking of COVID, I was out with your girlfriend last night. She stopped by, just off the COVID list. Her friend Angelica. She's doing well.
How's she doing?
All right, but she had a pretty good bout with the COVID. She was 103 for a couple of days. The temperature, and she has zero sense of smell. She just got over it.
It's, well, around you, Chief, that might not be the worst.
That's what
thing.
I said. I didn't. Why did I even shower? She goes, I couldn't tell.
she said, did you?
Oh, no. But, I mean, she's done. She had a rough bout. She's a healthy girl. I mean, this thing is not a joke. I mean, it absolutely is not.
But it's not a joke, but we're also handling it in ways that are just, sporadic at best, right?
Pretty much everything wrong.
Yeah, pretty much everything wrong. But, Kevin, in regards to the, unfortunately, I've had some experience with this, you know, with parts delays and things like that at Pullman. There's a basicness to this, if that's such a word. In order for you to proceed on anything, let's just say, for instance, you need like five things. You need part A, part B, the screw to put them together, the screwdriver to put the screw in with, and the guy to turn the screw. And if you're missing any one of those, you've got a problem. And if you're missing any one of them, to stack up on the other ones or to work overtime or do anything like that, is totally useless. I mean, you either have everything or you have nothing. Am I right?
That is pretty well true. If you can't bolt two parts together, what good is having the two parts?
Or what good is having the bolt? Two parts aren't them. I think there's always going to be what they used to call in chemistry a rate determining step, the one that actually is the problem in any chemical reaction. I mean, and I think we're running into these bugs. Do you think, if you had to summarize it, do you think it's a somewhat of a China issue? Is it the COVID on top of the China issue? Is it the tariffs that when Trump essentially tried to stop trade with China as a hammer against those people? And again, I have no great love for the Chinese government and what they're trying to accomplish. But as a matter of fact, I'd say I have no love for it. Did he not understand what he was doing? Did he cause it? Did the COVID on top of it cause it?
Pre-pandemic, when the tariffs were in place, were we having a hard time sourcing parts? And if you remember the discussions that we had back then, the answer was no, they were more expensive, but parts were still coming into the country. Large companies that were that had bargaining power were able to negotiate, splitting the difference or even having the Chinese pay all the tariffs. So many supply chains moved to other countries and sourcing went to other countries, but we were getting stuff in. So right now the biggest problem that we have is stuff is stacking up at the ports. We can't even get it into the country. Now, there's side problems with that, and one of the big side problems is that we are importing too much stuff. Not that there's you know, not that that has ever been considered a wrong thing, but I think companies are finding out that when it comes to certain kinds of parts and so on, that you can't do just in time from that far away, and then experience a disruption and expect to survive it. So, it, you know, this is a lesson the Japanese learned, the Japanese auto manufacturers learned when there was a tsunami, what, 8-10 years ago, something like that, and they found out that you've got to have some just-in-case inventory to go along with your just-in-time process. So that's part of it. But how idiotic, you know, the press conference a couple days ago, how idiotic was that?
Oh, pretty good.
You know, how long have we been experiencing supply chain problems? How long have the ships been backed up? I mean, I found articles from the early spring about how this backlog is dragging on. And now in mid-October, it dawns on somebody that maybe we ought to work night shifts too?
Well, first of all, I'm sure they already were, if they were able to. That's the part I don't get, Kevin. There's a progression here, and just because it's the day that the press jumps on it. I mean, if you and I had this is what I've been really, you know, bitching about here for 2 weeks. Whether, and I keep giving these guys more credit than they're due, probably, when we had the Time and Newsweek and stuff that people actually bought and they had in there doing really good articles, I would love to see a list of how many ships, how many containers have been unloaded per day or per week, whatever, for the last 20 years. And you know, what the rate is, what the other stuff, what the tonnage is, how long when a ship shows up. I don't think when a ship shows up, there's automatically a spot in the dock for them with a mariachi band welcoming them. I really don't. I mean, is the normal wait, what was the wait 10 years ago? Was it 3 days, two days?
The normal backlog is at most, you know, like two ships. And yeah, they don't just show up unannounced. You know, they're communicating all the way across. So it's sort of like, you know, when truck drivers go to deliver at Walmart, they have time slots. And if you miss your time slot, then you're going to have to wait. But otherwise, there's time slots at the loading docks. It's scheduled out like the day before, 2 days before. And you better show up. If your time slot is between 10 and 10:15, you better pull up to the loading docks between 10 and 10:15. Or they're going to tell you, sorry, you can't deliver, you know, today. We're busy. So this is all scheduled out. This is, you know, this is normal.
But how, I guess my point is...
It isn't just a surprise where they're saying, okay, who's here now?
I get that.
They've been communicating for days about that.
I get that, but what I'm saying is when maybe it wasn't even Trump. Maybe it started before then where there were problems with some of the source places in China or someplace. What I'm saying is the day the press finds out about it and we all of a sudden start to rag about it all day long is not the day it started. I mean, were there already small issues where maybe people, you know, maybe it started in China where some places went out of business or they got a combination, all of a sudden they couldn't supply. I mean, the real history of the millions of parts that come this way, I'm going to say that if you went back probably 2 or 3 years, it was already starting on some level. And when maybe even before Trump even got in office, it was already starting on some level, and it just creeps. I mean, and when you say the just in time, maybe the ports are just in time. The last time I drove skiing, I stopped in, I drove myself, so actually I drove back from there with a car I'd bought, or truck. And I stopped in, the hell was that? One of the little towns, North Platte, Nebraska or someplace where everybody stops. And I'm in this hotel bar because it was early enough. And I start talking to this guy whose job was, he was the Union Pacific Railroad guy. And his job, he had like a 50 miles of track that were his. And I noticed that if you're getting tired, you're driving on I-80, sometimes the headlights coming at you, you think it's a car, it's a train because the train tracks are right next to the, and there was a train, Kevin, like every, almost like, I'm sitting there going, every like 10 minutes I'm seeing a train. What the hell's going on? And, you know, this is the original road west, you know, the connected the country together. And, so I said, what's going on? He says, we have a train every 15 minutes. That's how crowded we are. And this was, God, Kevin, this had to be 15 years ago. And he goes, Every train, the maximum speed of a freight train is 55 miles an hour. Everyone goes exactly 55 miles an hour. Because if not, you're catching up on the guy in front of you or the guy behind's catching up on you. He said it's so crowded that if you have a siding, unless it's like maybe on a Sunday or something, we can't even get your railroad car onto the siding because we can't pull into the pattern. So my question is it been like a fine-tooth comb like that at these ports for the last 10, 15 years, and then some combination of either some supply disruptions, maybe Trump's fault, maybe not, then all of a sudden COVID, all of a sudden, my point is if you get backed up, well, he told me they had a derailment where they didn't have a train go by for a day. He said, we were bleeped up for like a month. The trains that were stacked up to get them all going to get back out to their separation of 15 minutes apiece took like a month. So my question is, if they had a week or two.
And Tom, that's what I've been saying, is when you knock a supply chain out of equilibrium, it takes forever for it to get back. When you knock a whole bunch of interdependent supply chains out of whack for months at a time, which we did by sending people home, which we made worse earlier this year by paying people to stay home, and having disincentive to work, and which was, you know, in every polling, bit of polling that I saw, was slightly less than half of the people who were collecting unemployment benefits said, yeah, I'll go back to work when I don't get the supplemental anymore. So maybe we'll see some of the employment situation change. But and frankly, if we're not operating ports 7x24, then, you know, why not when it gets bad? And, you know, I'll also ask the question, where the hell is Pete Buttigieg in all of this? He's the transportation secretary. I have not heard a peep from all year about any of these problems.
I haven't either. But I'm going to say, Kevin, if it turns out that during the darkest depths of the COVID situation, that the port itself went from, I'll pick a number, 10 ships a week down to 5, they could have caused their own problems. But now the question is, okay, now the solution is, let's work overtime and let's make the 10 ships a week, let's make the 10 15. Well, a third grader knows that. But now the question is, what is the rail capacity? What is the truck capacity? Do we have the ability to up our capacity 50% to catch up? And I'm going to say the answer is probably no.
Are we just moving the bottleneck someplace else, is what you're saying?
I'm saying the answer is probably no. That you can do 11 a week and we're just going to have to ride it out. I mean, that's my first blush. Now, if I was there, I mean, I have some training in this. If I was there, I could give you a better answer. I couldn't fix it, but at least I'd know the information I'd need to tell you at least here's the real problem. It may be, well, that's fine, but maybe the trains I'm talking about at 15 minutes apart, if all these places double their capacity, where are we going to put them? Maybe the rails can't handle them. Okay, well, let's shove them all on trucks. Well, wait a minute. How many truck drivers do you need to replace one train, for God's sake? 50? 100?
Well, what happened with trucking when the Colonial Pipeline was shut down for the better part of a week?
Yeah.
Remember what happened with trucking?
Well, yeah, we don't have, because why would you have enough when you have a pipeline? Right?
Correct. So what happened is, all of a sudden, that cascaded all over the country because people who needed fuel in the east said, I'll pay anything to get it trucked here. And so you come to the Midwest, and people who had, who needed trucking, it was kind of, well, sorry, they're, you know, these people out east are willing to pay me, double time. See you later. I'll be back in a few weeks. this all cascades through. It's just the inattention to it is more than anything else, I think, is...
Well, and the hysteria of the national
and
media.
Do you think the president has any clue about what you just raised?
No.
You know, where's the capacity bottleneck right now, and what are we going to do about it? Because if you can't get all of that stuff headed eastward out of the ports, then, you know, you can stack it up all you want. Now, there is capacity, I'm sure, to stack more containers in the yard. You can stack those things up pretty high. So there's probably more capacity for that, but then, you know, a lot of good it does you. It just means, it just means it's like holding a bunch of extra work in process inventory. That doesn't do you any good.
Well, you know what would else would be interesting? And this would be a, I mean, of course, I never heard anything like this, but I mean, our press, whatever our current press is, let's put it this way. The entertainment shows that masquerade as news shows all day long, I'll tell you what, one thing you could do, Kevin. We just got this new Panama Canal. Send some of the ships to New Orleans or Baltimore. But now, what does it cost a ship to go through the Panama Canal? $500,000? Can we lower that for a month to down to say $50,000? Then maybe we can end run some of it that way.
Chief, correct me if I'm wrong. Doesn't the United States have control or own that port?
No. Panama Canal? No, we gave it back to them.
Oh, but we also have, you know, we do have, and they're backed up too. We have ports all the way up the Eastern Seaboard, and in the Gulf of Mexico. So, you know, the Long Beach and Los Angeles are the biggest, and obviously with everything that comes from Asia, that makes sense. But it is a long way around, and I don't know if you could divert things there reasonably or not, or if you just need to, you know, recalibrate the system as it is. Look, there's all kinds of things. They allow young truck drivers you can get a CDL in many states, and you can haul all kinds of stuff if you're 19 or 20, but you can't do it across state lines because that's interstate commerce and it's not allowed. Maybe that is something that we could relax. Allowing, you know, like they did during that short period of time when the pipeline was down, allowing a couple of extra hours a day for drivers on the road would increase capacity. And there are things, you know, trimming around the edges that we could do that would help. And right now, anything that helps is something that should be done. And but let's have a commission about it instead.
Oh yeah.
My favorite from the president's press conference was, well, we need the private sector to step up. If they don't step up, we're going to call them out. What the hell do you think the private sector has been doing all along? They want to get all their hands on this stuff. They'll do anything. You know, they're paying out the wazoo for it now, just to get what the scraps that they're able to get.
Kevin, I can remember
so
meetings.
Idiotic.
I can remember meetings.
Really appalling.
Well, I can remember meetings at Pullman when all of a sudden we got a bunch of supplies in. The reason why I keep saying this is what happened. It's actually kind of an interesting little story as to why we got so screwed up on the railroad car contract that I was working on. We ended up, City of Boston had not bought new commuter cars for, I'm going to say 60 years. I mean, really long time to where, what I understand, the old cars, there were holes in the floor where you could like see the tracks going by underneath and people were riding in them. It was that bad. So the idea that they were going to get these new cars was really something. They're single level push pull cars, not like the double, because they had to go through a couple tunnels someplace, and you couldn't put bigger cars in there. Anyway, we had a schedule and we were on schedule, and all of a sudden the governor calls up, and the contract had been signed 25 cars with an option for 35 more, for a total of 60. So Pullman priced the thing, this is before I got there, not that I would have made any difference if I was there, they priced it essentially for the 60, because in their experience, They needed 60. They needed 200. So they're going to order the 60, right? Well, of course, politically in the middle, the bump, who is the governor of the state, calls up and says, you know, you got that first car due in November? Yeah, well, I need it in, like, July. Because I'm running for governor, and this is a big deal. And I want the first car here during my campaign so I can show it off to everybody that I brought new cars here that nobody's done in 60 years or 50 years, whatever it was. So, and if you don't do it, you're not getting the 35 extra. So, this is one of the reasons why I have my incredibly jaundiced view of government and politicians in general. So, if it had just been a few weeks, you probably could have pulled it off. But it was so much earlier that Pullman had to call all the suppliers and essentially ask these guys to pay for like a special build. It wasn't like you could move the whole process up. It was so early, you had to essentially special build like one item or two items or whatever the seats were more than one item, and make it all a separate build. So when you're done with that, you still had to start over and do like the regular run, which was absolutely the worst thing to do you could do to anybody, or including Pullman. So sure enough, these guys are such car makers, they're such, you know, they were such craftsmen. We get the damn thing together and we send it out there. Well, what do you think happened? The guy lost the primary. He didn't even run for governor. So here we are now. We ended up losing $3 million on his contract that we should have made three, and almost all of it was because of that. And because now we had some parts coming in late, some people come parts coming in real late, some early, and we had to rent a warehouse to store the crap that came in early because they said, well, I'm starting my run in July, you're getting everything by November, we had no place to put it, so our attempt to go, so it doesn't take much to screw something up. And once you do, you know, you really have to go back and you have to spend some time. I mean, Buttigieg should be sitting there if he knows anything about this stuff. We say, okay, where is it? Now, if you actually unload 50 more containers a year, where are they going to go? Well, 30 of them are going to go in Union Pacific, some are going to go in Southern Pacific. Okay, now are they ready to take them for you? Do you have the railroad cars to put them on? Well, not exactly. They don't have them because now they're all in Chicago. We got a deadhead trains back this way. I mean, there's a million pieces to this puzzle, like you say, Kevin. And
Buttigieg should have been totally plugged into this because he comes from a region that that its economy has under his during his watch grew in the distribution area, and because it's not just trucking here. We've got one of the biggest rail yards in the and switching yards in the country. I think Elkhart is the second biggest. We've got Port of Indiana nearby. Not that Great Lakes shipping is a huge component of it, but it's significant, and it's a port operation that's important. And then we do have a rather substantial trucking industry here, and we have a rather substantial there's a lot of pipelines coming through, and all of those things that are in the distribution area are right here.
Yeah,
and he can't be oblivious to it. He can't possibly be oblivious to it. But you know what the priority was? Get those electric cars booming.
Oh yeah. Hey, by the way, speaking of right here, I think we got Carl right here. So Kevin, we got a Dash. We'll talk at you next week. No game tomorrow, eh? The bye.
No game. We're playing the University of Bye.
Yes. All right. SP Futures up 16. NASDAQ Futures up 51. Be right back, Mr. Carl Denninger.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com. PTIProDirect.com.
Are you one of the millions of people who suffer with pain? Do you wake up in the morning with stiffness in the lower back or neck? Why are you using medication to cover up the symptoms without treating the actual cause? Painkillers, muscle relaxants, and anti-inflammatories are not the answer. At ChiroMed, physicians are trained to detect the cause of your symptoms and to correct the underlying problem. If you're ready to listen to common sense and do what it takes to make changes in your body that can affect your health for the rest of your life, give ChiroMed a call and set up a complimentary consultation. They are located in Orland Park and can be reached at 708-403-2727. 20,000 patients over 22 years have been treated at ChiroMed, and over 90% of them have had positive results without medication or expensive surgery. Isn't it time you did something good for your body too? Give ChiroMed a call. 708-403-2727. That's 708-403-2727. Let's get you pain-free and living again.
Hear ye! The Homer Broadcasting System is on the air!
Stocks, jocks,
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control!
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
she's a good girl. Loves her mama, loves Jesus. In America too, she's a good girl. She's crazy about Elvis, loves horses. And her boyfriend too. And it's a long day living in Reseda. There's a freeway running through the yard, and I'm a bad boy, 'cause I don't even miss her.
Hello, back at Stocks and Jocks. As we hear's up 16, Nancy, if he's up 50, are you playing that because Carl now lives in Tennessee, or what? Do you think all those girls are after him?
It's possible.
We have Mr. Carl?
Hello.
So you got a bunch of young ladies that love their mama and their boyfriend too, and you're the boyfriend?
Well, you know, that wouldn't be bad.
No, it's you know, as you age, you find you run into a lot of young ladies that you keep saying, where the hell were these young ladies when I was 25? You know, it's weird.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know who they were. They didn't think I was anything worth paying any attention to because I was too geeky and not muscly enough, I guess, would be the way to put it. You know, all the power was up in the top, so on the outside. So.
Well, I was on the south side, and the girls were on the north side, I think. I don't know, whatever it was. There was a... Anyway, so let me get this straight, Carl. By the way, I was absolutely fascinating what I read about the tulips today, about how when the thing got really bad, they canceled all the futures contracts and just made people pay a penalty and essentially turn to an option contract. The more I read about this tulip thing, I feel like I'm reading the next year's newspaper with this crypto.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. When I was writing Leverage, a huge part of the information that, you know, that kind of synthesized into what that book became was history. And of course, in order to actually understand it, you have to go back and make sure you didn't screw up what you remembered, right?
Yep.
Which so, you know, you have to go back to some primary sources too, because you can't trust things like Wikipedia and, you know, places. I mean, it's the craziness in our world today. Anyone that thinks that this just started in the last year or two is nuts. I mean, it's been the selective editing of history has, you know, is gone on forever. You know, I mean, just look at, you know, go into any medical or dental office, the dentist or the surgeon or whoever has a mask on. Well, guess what? We knew in 1981 that they didn't work in operating theaters. That was proof. And yet the mystique is still there, and it carried through into the whole thing of COVID. Well, for crying out loud, how long is that? That's 40 years ago. Right? So, I dug into this thing, and yeah, the tulip mania thing, when it started to crack, and of course, the problem with that is if you bought them and hadn't paid yet, and all of a sudden didn't have the money, you were the only one with the pull, right?
Yeah, I know.
They essentially turned them into futures contracts, and then turned them into options contracts, where, so sad, they expired, worthless, have a nice day.
Yeah, so, you know, it's funny you mentioned that about the mask. I remember reading it one time when I was very young. I had tonsillitis, of course, and they didn't want to take them out till you're like five or four, or however old I was. And so constantly, whenever you got the fever, the doctor would like come over with his little bag, and you get the penicillin shot basically in the ass, and with those old needles that they would actually like recycle and steam. Those things were like those things were like harpoons, not like the ones today. But after a long period of time, I read somewhere like 30 years ago, some guy actually did a study that every time you get, you know, basically shot in the ass or the arm or wherever it is, you always see people with the alcohol swab. And somebody did a big study and said, it doesn't do anybody any good. Because it doesn't really clean deep down enough. But it's like a prophylactic. But to this day, people, you know, hit you up with a little bit of alcohol before they stick you.
Well, you know, and you know what's funny about that is that I ordered some COVID antibody tests, because I ran out of the ones that I had. So you can't just walk into a store and buy them in the U.S., but you can order them online and from reputable places. You know, they come from England and places like that, not China somewhere. You don't know what the blanky blank is actually being tested for. And, you know, when they really are regulated, if they really do care, and you can get these things. Well, guess what? In the package, along with the little lancet that, you know, sticks your finger like a diabetic uses, there's an alcohol swab.
Yeah. I guess it doesn't hurt,
No, it doesn't do any harm.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, you'd be better off washing your hands in warm water and soap, because the warm water increases the blood flow slightly, which is the whole point. You're trying to get a drop of blood, right?
Yeah.
Well. Right. So that's, and that's just one of those things that, there's so much of this. And, you know, to kind of tie into what you were talking about in the last hour, this whole thing with supply chains. Biden gets up there and says, we've reached agreements with FedEx and UPS and Walmart and Amazon, and we're going to add 5,000 containers a week to the capacity by running 24 hours a day. Okay, do you realize that that's like half of one of those big ships?
I thought one of those ships holds 20,000 containers.
Well, like, it depends on the size of the ship.
Yeah,
okay?
Obviously.
They come in different sizes. But point being, 5,000 containers a week is nothing.
Nothing, yeah.
It's nothing. And the other, so the problem isn't so much that they can't get the containers off the ship. It's that there's nowhere for them to go once they do that. If you remember, it was probably 3-4 weeks ago, there was an intentional slowdown in unloading at Long Beach and some of the other ports. And the reason was that the trains and the trucks could not get the containers where they needed to go and get the empties back. And the empties have to go back to China in order to get filled back up again. Otherwise, they run out of empties.
Yeah, okay, so at one point, you got to almost have to deadhead a ship back with nothing but empties, which is nobody wants to do.
Well, but here's the, hopefully what they'd like to do is have, grain in them or something in them that they get paid to carry, right?
Right.
Because the ship really doesn't cost much more to run full of empty containers or full of full containers. There's some difference in operating cost and fuel burn and stuff, but not a lot. Most of the energy used to move a ship is used to move the hull through the water, not to actually move the cargo.
Well, so that's why it's so cheap.
It's one of those things where it's kind of like an airplane, okay? It costs this many gallons of fuel to fly it from one place to another. The other button, the seat, doesn't really add very much to the amount of fuel that the plane burns. So the thing is that what we have at this point, it's the supply disruption is multifaceted. When we were going through the Great Recession and fuel costs were extremely high, these ships to a large degree were running slow steaming instead of normal speed. And that cuts their fuel consumption by more than half. But the difference in speed is about 4, maybe 5 knots. We're talking about a ship that normally makes 23, 24 at its normal power level. So you're talking about a ship that normally goes about 23, 24 knots. Okay, at slow steam, it goes 19. Okay? Takes longer to get there. But it burns half as much fuel doing it, because the fuel burn goes up at an exponential basis as you start to go faster. It's just, it's like anything else. The energy is maybe at 1/2 mv², right? So as you go up, the resistance, water resistance, just like air resistance, goes up the square of the velocity. And so if you want to go faster, it costs you much more money in terms of the amount of fuel that gets burned by the engine that drives the ship. And so they were running slow steam for a couple of reasons. Number one is that they didn't need to get there faster. Number two is that the fuel cost to do it was ridiculous. And the people on the other end were balking at the additional cost being added to the, it's this much per container to go from here to here. Well, now fuel is getting expensive again. And yet we now have all these ships backed up on the other end. Well, why would you steam at normal speed from China to Long Beach when you're just going to sit there and anchor for them? What they have before you can unload the ship. That's stupid.
Well, if it's me, I want to get off this ocean. It's a long enough trip as it is. Just saying.
Well, you got this latency that you can't, that you can't get around, all right? I mean, there's this many miles of ocean you have to cross, right? And so that's just how that works. But the bottleneck is not the inability to get the containers off the boat. It's that in order to get the containers off the boat, They have to go somewhere else. They have to be unloaded at the destination, okay, or broken if it's a partial shipment, and it, you know, broken down into other things. And then that empty has to make its way back, hopefully with something else that China wants, back out there and get returned over to China so it can get filled full of whatever, you know, machine parts or toys or whatever again to come back over here another time. And until that cycle is complete, there's nothing you can do about it. So, the idea, and here's the thing, we've broken this internally, okay, and this is not just China, this is a multifaceted problem. We have people on these ships that they because we've got restrictions all over the globe, and they're all different. So you're a Filipino dude who's, by the way, they're a huge percentage of the crew, okay, not the flag officers on the bridge, but the actual guys that make the boat go. I guess it's a great job compared to what they can get in the Philippines. Okay, so this is a very common vocation.
Same thing on your cruise ship.
Right. Well, same thing like a cruise ship. Right? It's the same sort of thing. Okay, so these guys, wherever they started, their company was like, look, you have to be vaccinated in order to be able to, to come ashore. Okay, fine. So they went and took the jab. Then they get to China, and China doesn't recognize that particular jab because it's the wrong brand. Okay, so they can't get off the boat. So they end up stuck on the boat. The thing's in port getting loaded. They can't go into town and go screw around and do their usual, sort of things that people do. They can't because they can't go through immigration. So then they go to the next place to unload. They come to Long Beach, and they've got the same thing going on in L.A. Okay, they can't get off the boat in California for the same reason, because the United States has slammed the same sort of restrictions on people. No vaccine. Sorry, the only vaccines we recognize are J&J, Moderna, and Pfizer. Well, you can't get J&J, Moderna, and Pfizer in China. You can't get it in the Philippines, and you can't get it in Japan. The only place you can get it is here. You can't get off the boat, sir. Sorry. Have a nice day. And so these guys, after it's been a year and a half now, they've been dealing with this. Before they were vaccinated, you can't come in at all. Now that you can't come in because you've got the wrong one. And their contracts typically run a year, or 2 years, whatever. When they're done, do you think they're going to sign up again for this?
No, it's a. I mean, the complexity of it. I mean, I keep giving examples of places, Carl, that I worked that at the time I thought were pretty complex, and they're nowhere near as complex. It's the stuff we're talking about here, and it just seems to me that I guess I'm watching people on TV, they would have no knowledge. I mean, they weren't lucky enough to work in a factory like I was for a while, or run a place like you did. I mean, you have much more feel for it than I do, but it's, to me, I always thought it was really a problem, and the people who figured out, you look around, every year we can't wait to knock down another rail line somewhere in a city. I mean, we can't wait to shut things down because nobody wants it in their neighborhood, and yet we wonder why the system somehow is straining it. I mean, I don't know the system, whole idea when you went from the whole rail system that I understand is designed to ship, to move cars around, railroad cars. But now you start,
cars, yeah.
When you start putting, three and four, some of the bigger cars now, it's three or four containers on the car, and all four containers are going to a different spot. Now that's a whole different can of worms than the car having to go someplace, right? So that means when you get to Chicago and the Union Pacific, and all of a sudden you're going, the car you can get easily through the clearing yard to the chassis system or the Norfolk and Western and start heading east, or the IC and heading south, well, Canadian National. You can do that with the car relatively easily, and they've been doing that for 60 years or 100 years. Now, the container on the car, now you got to put that on a truck. You got to truck it to the spot where the chassis is loading it onto their flat car, right, or their container car. Now that's another mess, which is a problem in the city, right? So now you have to handle this thing way more. I mean, these things start to, there's little bottlenecks every place. Am I wrong? I mean, so you just,
well, no, you're right, and this is the problem, is that so the ship gets unloaded, and it's a manual process. There's a guy in that crane, okay. And that is a skilled job, by the way. If you drop one of those things, then bad things happen.
Oh, yeah.
it's a little on the heavy side. Right?
Plus the stuff in it is very valuable.
Well, never mind the stuff in it. I mean, the damage, it'll destroy a truck chassis.
Oh, yeah.
The amount of energy involved in one of those things, falls, 3 inches is ridiculous. So, that is a skilled job. There's a guy in the cab of the crane that does this. And he puts it down on top of the truck, and it locks onto, it's a carriage. It's 4 pins that lock into the corners of the container. And that thing is, now that can be hauled by a truck. And they're 40 feet long because there's a length limit and a mass limit. Right, so basically the deal is you can only have 80,000 pounds on it in most areas over the road. Okay, there's some exemptions and there's some different rules in different places, but generally speaking, for an 18-wheel truck, the weight limit's 80,000 pounds. So you have to load, and of course the container weighs something, right? It's not zero. So that's why you have these units, these TEUs, and an actual unit is half of a container. A TEU is a 20-foot long.
Right, that's the standard one, yeah.
Yeah, so the 40-foot one's 2 TEUs, okay? So they get loaded, but then, they either go on a truck or they go on a train car. Right? And on a train car, you can stack them, multiples. You can go too high, and you can go, I think it's 2-3 long, on one train car, same deal. And then you get to wherever but at the end of the day, for essentially all of these, when you get to the other end, a truck has to be the final mile of that going to wherever it goes.
Right.
Right? And then when it gets unloaded, okay, well, look, you got to, if it goes by train, at the other end of the train yard where the truck is, there's another guy with a crane that has to unstack it from the train and put it on the truck chassis so it can go to wherever it's going. And if there's any kind of a problem anywhere in there, you got truckers that, they say, well, we're not putting up with these mandates. We're not dealing with this. So, sorry, have a nice day. Goodbye. And there's been a problem with this with trucking companies for a while because when you get a CDL, your life is no longer yours. Okay, you get pulled at random. Here, go pee in this bottle.
Yeah.
Right? There's no more cheating with electronic logs either. When they say you can only drive this many hours, the log is electronic. It's built in the truck. You're not going any further than that. You're not going to, and it's illegal to do it. If people used to cheat with the paper logs all the time, you can't do that anymore.
Oh, you wouldn't believe
the truck knows what it's moving. It's got a GPS in it.
You wouldn't believe the stuff that used to go on. Part of it is regulation like it is today. Allied Van Lines, my first job, because an individual person couldn't just have a moving company and go pick up the stuff in Carl's house and drive it from Florida to Tennessee, it was all regulated. You needed paper. The permit to go from Florida to Tennessee. And to buy that was a big deal. So, of course, in 73, 74, all that, or 75, all that changed. But Allied Van Lines, where I worked, in the corporate office, what they did is provided the national cover for all these local guys. So the Allied truck actually was like Grable, Wisconsin, or Pickens Cane, Chicago, or someplace. But they didn't have the paper to go 50 states, but Allied did. So you became an agent of Allied Van Lines.
Right.
So you did all your local moving and all that stuff. The packing was all yours. Whenever you went across state lines, you ran an Allied paper. So they had a whole section in Broadview. All they did was maintain people's logs and stuff. I don't think they ever got audited, Carl. And these guys, they were masters at stopping some place where they had the girlfriend for like 5 hours and then driving 12 and somehow, they were absolute masters at making those logs not exactly work, right? I mean, and the states make it even worse because you have to buy a certain amount. When you see gas tax or tax on diesel, the states aren't this stupid. I mean, you would think they would be, but they're not. That truck can put enough gas in it at the spot, where the place was, or at ICX, or the other trucking company I worked. I don't think they could make it to Denver, but they sure as hell could make it across Illinois and Iowa. But you can't. You have to have somebody calculate, okay, I have to buy a certain number of gallons in Illinois and Iowa. I can only start this, 100-gallon tank out with 15 gallons because I got to buy so much along the way because I got to be able to, I can't have it overflowing. So every state you go through, you have to stop and buy. Otherwise, the gas tax doesn't do you any good, right?
There's actually a little more to it than that. There's an interstate compact on that. So if you, let's say that, you know, California, of course, has ridiculously high fuel prices because of the taxes that they charge. So if you, let's say that you intentionally fill in Arizona or Nevada to avoid having to buy any fuel in California, you'll end up having to send them a check.
Right.
Alright, so the independent guys in the companies, they don't do that. They've got a place, designated on each route. It's like, look, you know, you fill the truck here, you put this many gallons here, because nobody wants to send those checks. But as long as they balance out, then everything's fine. But any organization or any individual owner operator that's running multi-state, they don't want to have to deal with all that BS at the end of the year. So they don't. They just like, okay, you know, we got to put this much in so that everything balances. And nowadays, it used to be all that was done on paper, not anymore. Now it's all done by computer, so it's easy. It's like, well, you know, I got to put 42 gallons in the tank here.
Well, so I guess what we're trying to say, both Kevin and I and Carl and I, this is, there's a million pieces of this puzzle, and I don't know if you necessarily, people will work it out, Carl. I mean, there's always an imbalance. I mean, I worked at Allied in 1976, for God's sake. And they, at the end of the summer, in August, guess what? You had a lot of your empty trailers were in Arizona, Texas, and Florida. This didn't start. There never was a balance of people moving from Arizona back to Chicago. You always had more trips. So somewhere along the line, you had to say, okay, we got to get 30 guys. They're going to have to deadhead north. I mean, what else can you do, right? You can't beam them here like if Scotty was around. I mean, but you anticipate it early on. So if you get somebody in Arizona, you try and route them back here kind of with anything. But with a household goods trader, you really can't put other stuff on there other than household goods, right? You put something on there, I guess, but people didn't. So, I mean, it's not like you wouldn't expect a container imbalance between here and China. Of course you will. Even if it's small, there's going to be one, right?
Well, yeah, and that's the whole thing, is that we spent 20-plus years, really more than that, you think about it, so, you know, we're now 30, going on close to 40 years. We spent more than 20 years internationalizing and lengthening these supply chains without paying a single bit of attention to all of the interconnected pieces and all of the different people who have to touch that thing from one place to another. And it goes back to the sort of thing that I was saying during the 08-09 crash. The cheapest, easiest, and most able to be understood lending transaction is, you have some money, I want to build a house, you loan it to me. Okay?
Yeah.
And that's the easiest transaction, and everybody understands how that works. As soon as you start putting things together and slicing and dicing and securitizing all that sort of stuff, you put other people in the middle of it. Now you got lawyers involved, now you got deal makers involved, now you got brokers involved. Everybody gets paid because nobody works for free. The complexity goes up, and somebody along the line can get screwed, and that screwing can be either unintentional or intentional. And you may not catch it until a year, 2 years, 5 years later when it comes time for you to get paid, and all of a sudden, oops, these guys defaulted, and guess what? You have the junior notes and you don't get anything. Well, the same thing happens in a supply chain like this, except this time, it's not you don't get paid, it's you don't get your bearings.
Yeah. Well, I mean, let's take one, so let's nudge up a little bit with this blend of containers and these ships, and it seems like such this... For 90% of the population, and me too, because I'm not a container ship expert. But I mean, you look at this and you say, wow, but just take one item that I know a little bit about, because I read it, I'm not in the business or anything, but you probably know more. But if you go to the store and you buy a pair of blue jeans, okay, you buy them and you try them on, and, you know, maybe after COVID you got to get a size bigger. I mean, who the hell knows? But the point is, it seems pretty simple to you, right? Well, it's not simple, because guess what? They're probably, well, I don't know now, but they were made in China probably 5 years ago. But if you think about it, where do you think the cotton came from? Well, the cotton came from here, right? Aren't we the biggest exporters of cotton in the world, mostly to China? So,
yeah.
Somebody somewhere in a southern state, someplace, you know, I'm not talking about the cotton gin and the guys hanging out there picking it by hand, but somewhere here there's a farm where somebody's growing cotton. And now he's got to get that cotton. Now he might use the futures on the CBOT, They have cotton futures. He may use the futures. He may have his the local guy might hedge him for him. Somehow or another, that cotton's getting on a train, and it's getting, I'm going to guess, to New Orleans. And somewhere along the line, it's getting, or it's going west on the Southern Pacific or to Santa Fe, to Long Beach, and that cotton's going to China. And it gets to China, and somebody puts it on a truck there, takes it to the Levi manufacturer, over the else is over there. Somebody makes these pants. There's dye coming from someplace. There's buttons coming from someplace. There's thread coming from someplace. This is a big deal. This is just for a pair of pants. And now all of a sudden, another finished pair of pants comes back to the wherever the port is, gets back in another container, and it's on its way here. And now the whole process starts all over again once it gets here, back to someplace, back to the Target, or the hell you buy the damn things. This is, what would you say, it's got to be a 50-stage transaction for a pair of blue jeans, right?
Well, yeah, and that's the whole problem with doing this, is that we allowed this. We in America, we cheered this on because it makes the stock price go up by a nickel.
Yeah.
Okay, and you know, all of us, I mean, look, who doesn't like a roaring stock market, right? Everybody loves a roaring stock market. Well, guess what? The way you got it is by, when you look at all these additional costs, all these layers you put in, and again, nobody works for free, but the bottom line is the guy over in China or Thailand or Vietnam or wherever who's sewing the pants, he's doing that for a dollar a day.
Yeah, he has to be
here, it's $20 an hour.
But he has to be so much cheaper than the person here.
But the point is, as long as everything runs the way it's supposed to, he is.
Right. We got to dash off the break here. We'll come back and explain to me how the inflation numbers this week have this massive stock market party going on. S&P is up 15, NASDAQ is up 51. You're right back, Stocks and Jacks.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to factor in the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other life decision. Your brain is smarter than your gut, and that's why you owe it to yourself to read Luckbox. We've made it easy because Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with timely, actionable trading ideas, and equips you with savvy investing tactics you don't already know, all while exploring how to live your best life through music, spirits, food, sports, travel, fitness, and a whole lot more. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on controlling their financial futures. It's for overachievers and alpha types who don't buy into Wall Street's investment gurus. It's for mavericks who believe in life, luxury, and the pursuit of happiness. It's for you! Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck, get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. We've talked a lot on the show about risk and suitability, about how your portfolio should match your age, income, and risk appetite. It's been hard for investors to maintain that suitability in the last several years due to a Fed strategy that has driven interest rates to virtually zero. You may have even heard that the Fed was trying to drive conservative investors to a riskier portfolio on purpose, for whatever reason. I'm sure you're aware of investors that took some increased risk, such as longer-term fixed income securities, and are now unhappy with that choice. At PTI, we've always stressed total portfolio risk awareness and tried to minimize chasing returns in a tough environment. Well, now it looks like maybe interest rates are moving more towards historical levels. Everyone needs to be aware of what that continued movement might do to your portfolio, both good and bad. We also have a stock market that seems to have stalled, at least for the short term. I think it's time for everyone to take a serious look at their goals, their risks, and their portfolios. Do they match? If not, we can help. We have a signature protected index program. We have ways to hedge against interest risk. We can make that portfolio right for you again. Go to PTISecurities.com or call us right now. The market can change very rapidly. That's PTISecurities.com.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Four more by Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Almas, Thomas Hall on the board. SP Futures up 14.50. They were up 17 when we came in, but still up. NASDAQ Futures up 46. They had an Empire State number that was really awful, but they don't really pay attention to those. That's the manufacturing activity in the Northeast. But we don't care. Our party line is that the economy is going great guns. Don't pay any attention to anything that says it isn't. So Dow up 166, sorry. Individual stocks making a move. We've got Caterpillar up $1.12. We've got Microsoft, which has been on a tear lately. It got down to like 280, and boy, you know, it was quite a buy, I guess, up to 303. Over in Asia, we've got Nikkei up 517. That's 1.8%. Shanghai up 14.4%. Hang Seng up 368, 1.4%. Now, they were closed yesterday, so it's a little bit of a catch-up on the Hang Seng, but still up a bunch. Over in Europe, we've got the DAX up 66.4, FTSE up 16.2. These were up earlier when we did this, up further earlier. CAC round up 26.4%, but they're still up pretty strong. Yesterday, Dow up 534, S&P up 74, it's a big move. NASDAQ up 251, 1.7%. We've got bonds up 3 basis points to 1.55. They just touched over 1.6, I'm going to say on Tuesday, for a bit, and then came back down, but now this is the rate. The bonds had gone back up. So they got to make sure that it's the inverse there. The bund up 1 basis point to minus 0.17. Japan steady at positive 0.06. We've got oil going up today, up 60 cents to 81.91. It was in danger of going under 80, and then it didn't, and then it came right back up. Brent up 79 cents, 84.79. Natural gas down 9 cents, 5.58. Out of all this stuff, natural gas was over 6, now had come back, you know, 10% here. RBOB up 2 cents, 246. Gold had been made a run up, but not so much today. Down 22 bucks, 17.75. Silver down 30 cents, 23.17. Copper up 8 cents, 471. Gold is in this mess with the dollar going, the dollar goes up, they go down, I mean, all that kind of stuff. Crypto up 1772 to 59,440. Again, the ETF. Speculation is that it's a go because it doesn't appear the Fed is going to try and stop it. Thomas, what do you have for us, Traffic Weather Sports?
All right, everybody, is now 7:34 here in the Chicagoland area, and our weather here is currently 60 degrees. We're going to reach a high of 62, Chief. There's a light chance of rain today. Our Phoenix listeners, they are currently at 56 degrees. They're going to reach a high of 86. The Chicago traffic is current. We have a first responders that are actually reporting to a rollover crash on the Stevenson outbound right before Pulaski. The left lanes are going to remain blocked and is going to cause a backup from there to about Damon Avenue. And as reported earlier on the Stevenson inbound route near Route 83, there looks to be like a left lane that was split into two, causing a slight delay as they enter into the downtown area. Chief, in sports, it was a very classic five-game series as the LA Dodgers advanced to the National League Championship Series, beating the Los Angeles Dodgers, beating the San Francisco Giants 2-1 on a controversial last called third strike by the first base umpire. The Thursday night football game was
I think he had a date.
What's that?
He had a date, I hear.
He had to get somewhere, and sure he left the field in quite a hurry.
Now, when you see a call like that, and then you see some smoking hot young lady telling you how great it is to bet during the game while you're at the ballpark, does anybody ever put two and two together?
Chief, I digress. The NFL game, there was the Tampa Bay Buccaneers going 5-1. Tom Brady led Buccaneers beat the Philadelphia Eagles 28-22. We do have a WNBA Finals game tonight as the Chicago Sky are going to host the Phoenix Mercury. Tip-off time is at 8, and you can see that on ESPN Dos. Chief.
Kyle, I was mentioning a little bit earlier, I don't know if you were catching it. Do you think the more we think that gambling is the salvation of sports, someday somebody going to question calls like last night?
Well, you know, you got to wonder. I think the reality is, you know, gambling is like anything else. We all know that it's a parasitic thing, and that for everyone who wins, somebody loses, right? And in fact, when you get down to it, it's even worse than that because the guy in the middle has to make some money, otherwise the sportsbook doesn't stay open.
and the state has to skim somehow.
Well, but see, I'm going to...
The state always gets their piece, too. So, I mean, you know, it's like any other casino game. If you play long enough, you'll go bankrupt. Other than poker, where you have to be good enough to stay ahead of the rake. And, so you don't just have to beat the other people at the table. You also have to beat the house rake. And over a long period of time, that's not easy to do.
No.
Okay? You go to Vegas. Vegas is still there, right? All the casinos are, we've got one, got out of Cherokee, go through the park and on the other side of North Carolina. There's a big butt casino there that it has not gotten smaller.
The only difference is Vegas now could care less if you gamble. Because the rates on everything. I've had people that have gone there after COVID. The biggest seller in town is the Walgreens selling 6 packs and 12 packs of water because it's $25 a bottle out of your little refrigerator in your room in some places. And one guy paid 30.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing is that it's like any other extractive part of the economy. Except that it's all voluntary. I mean, if you choose to gamble.
Yeah, but so the cynic that Chief tends to come across as, I would disagree with the call was a bad call. I don't necessarily think there was any deeper meaning other than he just looked at it wrong, right? There's been gambling going on since the Black Sox of, the early 1900s, right? So, I don't necessarily think that has anything to really do with a bad call of that nature. It's just magnified because there's social media and there's 8 different ways to look at the call.
I'm not accusing anybody. What I'm saying is that when I was young and observant and, the idea of gambling being even close to something like Major League Baseball or football was considered an anathema, where if you were even caught in a casino in the off season, you were like suspended. And now we're embracing it. We're saying, no, gambling is somehow going to save the sport. Well, people don't change. I'm not accusing anybody, Carl.
There's prohibition too, right? There was times when liquor were wrong.
I know. And now look at all the problems liquor causes. All right, I'm not saying we should have prohibition. I like to go out, but this is kind of an interesting segue, Carl, because I was going to ask you about the. We talked a little bit about the tulips, but the idea of this Bitcoin. It's funny. The guy lives in my building. He's a big Bitcoin. Of course, they've been telling other people to buy forever, but he's a big Bitcoin.
Right.
And I said, my feelings that it's not based on anything, and one of these days it's going to be worthless. And then the answer is, Chief, well, your currency is going to go worthless. I guess there's somewhat of an arrogance to this that somehow if you become a Bitcoin guy, you're leaving losers like me with the dollar in their pocket, one step behind, that you've made up something new and now you're a member of this New World Order, which rubs me a little bit the wrong way, but I can deal with that. But I guess what I'm saying, Carl, and please, you're never afraid to criticize it, is as much as I criticize the Federal Reserve and what they're doing by making the dollar cheaper, it's still something. I mean, I read some history a few weeks ago to the listeners about the Roman coins and how they started to get a little less gold as time went by and silver.
Right.
But it was still a Roman coin. It wasn't somebody walking in from Egypt and saying, here's your new currency. Oh, by the way, there's nothing behind it. I mean, there's a big difference between, as much as I don't like what the Fed's doing, between the U.S. dollar and the bridges and the gold and the silver and the aircraft carriers and the God knows whatever else they got, and Bitcoin, which has nothing. I mean, granted, they could, at their current pace, make it to the point where the dollar's worth not very much, but there's still no comparison, I don't think. Do you?
Well, no, I don't, and it's one of the things that I have pointed out over time is that until I can pay taxes in it, get back to me.
Well, I mean, I don't think, I mean, you and I have been probably, well, maybe Hal and Russell more, because we talk about this more than you and I do, but we're very upset with the idea that we're going to deflate the world's currency as a way to somehow pay debt and back to money, to people and money that's worth way less. I mean, I get it. Okay. I mean, I understand. And I think that's a horrendous thing. But it wouldn't surprise me that somebody came up, could be you and me, with an alternative currency. And especially with the way that the governments are fighting, and why should the dollar be the reserve currency when we feel like we're going to degrade it every day? But whatever it is, whatever it is, I think I've read enough currency theory in my life that we better have something behind it. That the new Chief Carl Shekel, that one unit is worth a quart of oil or something. There needs to be something behind the damn thing, or why would anybody use it? It needs to be worth a pack of cigarettes, like in a concert. It can't be worth zero, with the idea that some guy came with a beard, came off the mountaintop and created this thing and went back up there, and now it's just something for all the rest of us to use. I mean, it may be some kind of a currency, just because people in the dark area of the narcotics world want to use it because it can't get tracked, and as long as it stays between them. But someday, Carl, it's got to pop out in polite society. You might buy your tires in it from China, and the guy in China might be able to buy rubber someplace somewhere. Somebody's got to pop it into a real currency, don't they? And on that day, it's traceable. Or where am I wrong?
Well, no, you're right, and that's the whole issue with this is that and with cryptocurrencies, the bigger problem for anybody that is using them for nefarious things is that one mistake made at any point in time links everything you have ever done.
How does that work? Explain that to me.
Well, because every transaction is in that blockchain and is indelibly signed with a cryptographic signature that is admissible in court. There is no way to argue that it really wasn't you. Okay?
Yep.
That's just not there. And so the problem with it is that if you are following assiduously the ways that you can go through keeping yourself unassociated with a particular address, and there are ways to do that, and you never make a mistake, it is very hard to trace. It's very hard to figure out who it is that actually is the beneficial owner at point X or whatever. But one mistake ever in every single thing that you have ever done that is linkable back to that, no matter how remote, can be traced back from to all eternity to whenever that coin was originally founded. Every transaction you've ever committed, the bag of weed that you bought 5 years ago is all of a sudden has your name on it.
Well, hey, I have a question for a different one. I happen to know several people that maybe just for a lark bought $20 worth of Bitcoin 5 or 6 years ago in one of those machines, and of course they've managed to lose their password and so forth. Now, if somebody has an account here at PTI or any place, really, a bank or whatever it is, even a safety deposit box, if our client decides to get on a sailing ship to God knows where, and in the middle of the ocean, you know, gets attacked by a whale and down he goes, never seen or heard from again. After some period of time, our clearing firm or the bank or somebody is, if the letter's home and none of the kids show up and say I'm the heir or anything like that, or nobody calls and says the guy's dead and by the way, here's the estate. If none of that stuff happens over a period of time, RBC, the clearing firm needs to, or the bank needs to kick that money to the state to where it's available under that guy's name, you know, for a really long period of time. At some point, does somebody just get to take these at Bitcoin, or do they have to do the same thing? Are they impervious?
No, it just disappears. That's one of the things that's a huge problem that comes up with these, is that the system is inherently degenerate. Because if I have, let's say that I have a wallet, whether it's a software protected thing or it's a hardware thing, you know, they make these little things about the size of a credit card. And regardless of how it happens, I lose the password at the backup keys that allow me into this thing. Okay? Doesn't matter how it happened. They're lost. That whatever value allegedly is in that thing, how many Bitcoin, Ethereum, whatever are in there, they're gone.
But they're literally
gone.
But I mean, they're there. Somebody's going to get it.
Gets it, ever.
I refuse to believe that.
Well, the only way you can get it is to break the protocol, which destroys the integrity of the entire thing.
No, I'm saying you and I can't get it, but I refuse to believe somebody can't get it. I grew up on the South
Side. Chief, the design is such that if you could break that,
then the integrity of the entire system is gone. And all of a sudden, I can spend the same coin twice.
All right, so nobody knows that after 200 years, that here these 50 people, we haven't heard from them since the day they bought the stuff at $100, and now it's worth whatever, $1 million. It's just there. It's someplace. If the person's great grandkid somehow found a will with the thing in there, he could go in tomorrow and reclaim it. But other than that, it's just there.
That's right. And the problem is that the function of these setups is that there are a certain number of coins that mathematically can be allegedly quote unquote mined. There are only so many problems that can be solved before you run out. Okay. Therefore, because these things can be lost and are irreplaceable when that happens, because they're still out there, but nobody has access to them. There's no way to get back into them. For that reason, all of these systems are inherently deflationary.
Okay, so, but there's no mechanism, like, if somebody all of a sudden walked into a bank after 5 years, and if your name's not on the list, you can't get into the safety deposit. So, all of a sudden, someday you and I aren't going to be here, you've got kids, all of a sudden I don't, but your great-grandkid starts digging through some box that he found as a cornerstone in your house, and there's this piece of paper in there with this Bitcoin password on it. That guy can go into the system, use your password 100 years from now, and there's not any one quiz about who the hell is this guy and where, because Carl can't be here anymore. I mean, there's no hint.
That's right.
And all of a sudden, it's just okay for that guy to go.
Whoever has the key to the lock owns what's in the lock.
Okay.
And that's the way the system is designed. If nobody possesses the key because it has been physically destroyed, it's gone. You know, the dog ate my homework, right?
Right.
The dog actually eats your homework. All of that value is gone.
Cool. All right. So
yeah.
Before one question: why the numbers this week seem to confirm that we have a pretty serious inflation problem. We have the Fed Chief Bullard says it's clearly a monetary phenomenon. It has nothing to do with supply chain issues. He was on the other day. Nobody wants to believe. They couldn't wait to get him off. And yet here we have this massive bond rally the last 2 days. Not so much today. The bonds are going down. And this massive stock market rally. It's like let's trade like it's 1999 all over again. Am I going to see some huge bulge in the federal balance sheet this week? Or where did this come from, do you think? I mean, some of it's earnings.
I don't know, and what I don't get is that there's this mania view that it's getting to be very much like tulips, that there is absolutely no limit to where the Federal Reserve will let this go and where Congress can go. And let's face it, everything that the Fed does is because of the debt that Congress issues. If Congress never spends in debt, there are no treasuries to buy, and therefore the Fed cannot do anything. And so, you know, everybody likes to point at Powell and everybody, but the truth is that it's the 535 nut jobs sitting in the halls of Congress that create these problems every time. And the idea that there's no pressure that's going to end up coming down on these people, whether it be pure economic pressure or whether it be something much uglier than that, when people can't pay their heating bills and can't afford any food, is just wrong. And, you know, Volcker may have gone too far and he may have done too much, and, you know, I mean, there's a lot of debate that can be had over what happened there. But what isn't in question is where did the pressure come from that caused that originally? And it was the idea that Congress could not do this sort of thing, and then, you know, there's no consequence to it. They could change labor rules. They could change it. Well, guess what? We've been doing that for the last 18 months. We've been doing it for the last, 24 months. Trump started it with this idea that we're just going to hand people money because there was a virus running around.
It really started in 2007, 2008.
We bailed out every single bank and every single financial institution that did stupid things. And rather than let them go bankrupt, and you know, there were so many people screaming, oh, you can't do that. And, you know, we need to have this bank in here. And I said, look, there is a building with a vault in it on the corner of my street, right? If this bank goes bankrupt, somebody will buy that building for 5 cents on the dollar and open another bank.
Yeah.
There will be a bank.
Well, that's true. I just the thing that is, I don't see how it never really stopped, and I mean, it isn't stopping in Argentina, Venezuela, Iran. The beauty of it is because it's so uneven, Carl. For the Fed to do this, for assets to go up, for people to, that own the stock go up, I mean, inflation, I mean, someplace, somewhere, and I'm surprised it hasn't happened yet, Home Depot is going to have to report that our sales were up 10%, but oh, by the way, our prices were up 20%. And yet, and yet we've managed to dodge that. I mean, I had to buy a sheet of plywood a week and a half ago. It was a half inch, not even three quarter inch. It was $32. I mean, come on. Really? Now, and I know the lumber prices at the wholesale level, the futures have dropped way back down. And I said to the guy, I go, I see that the futures prices and the spot prices have come down, but yours haven't. He goes, you got that right. So someplace, somewhere, I mean, the amount of, I mean, I know you like to get into the, sometimes once in a while, and that this is going to have to come down on somebody's head pretty hard. I don't see if the world price of food starts to double what the normal person makes per day. I mean, it's not even. I mean, I'm looking around at my guys that do work in the building and do other places, and people, I don't see anybody that got a 10% raise last year. I mean, the people on CNBC basically were bitching yesterday, the nerve of those guys in, where the hell's, John Deere, what's the name of the town? They're in where? In Illinois here someplace. Anyway, I always...
Oh, in Iowa? Were they all on strike?
No, they're in Moline, right? Yeah, they went on strike, and the company was offering a 5.4% raise, and the people are thinking, man, that's quite a raise. And I'm thinking, if that raise was from 2 years ago, they're not even halfway there on the degradation and what they were paying them in the last 2 years. That's no raise.
That's right.
It's like the girl at Caddyshack, tanks for nothing, when the guy offered to marry her, right? And I mean, for God's sake, I mean, it should be 5.4% cost of living increase before we even talk about a raise.
I mean, yeah, but you know what we do? But see, here's the thing: we don't want to go down that road because everybody knows where that leads. Okay, we tried to do that when the unions had the power to enforce it years ago. We tried to track that, and what we ended up with was a time-shifted dislocation that ended up in the economy. It got really bad.
Well, and I have a theory on that, and I don't know why, Carl. This is the second time I've seen it. Okay, well, one, I was young. The second time, for some reason, and maybe you can explain to me this, Lucy, explain to me this. Why is it? I mean, I think just on its own, even if people did their job right, I was going through the CPI and the other day with whoever was on, the guest, Russell probably, and I don't think, somehow, I mean, I'm going back, this is the 70s, 80s routine, and the reason why I disagree with the way Volcker did things, but I also know why he did it, or think I do. Somehow or another, the CPI, part of it is political. Part of it is we don't want to show inflation, so I think that this has been running hot for 8 years, Carl. 8 years, maybe 10. But it's already been, it should, I mean, if you were to adjusted education, or adjusted medical stuff, and adjusted taxes, those kinds of things, we would have had a solid 4-5% inflation rate going back to 2009. Easy. Because when you have an 8% money supply growth, and you've got a 2.5% real growth, guess what? The difference is going to be inflation someplace. But because it landed in spots we don't count, like medical, which you're always talking about, it's somehow... But my point is, I don't think the poor guy or lady who's figuring out the price of brown rice, white rice, yellow rice, whatever kinds of rice there are, is really bleeping up on a CPI number. But somehow, it has become a very lagging indicator, and I don't know how often they do this. If rice goes up in July, does it get in the July numbers, or does it take a while? Because when I remember when we came out of the inflation thing last time, and when everybody remembers, people's wages, like you just alluded to, were still going up because they were still getting these cost of living raises. It was because the CPI was still going up. Even though Dr. J and I we just started trading, and we both would say to ourselves, or each other, once every couple of weeks, we'd go, Jan, what is this inflation? There is no more inflation. It stopped a year ago, but it took forever to pound its way through the system. And I think what you're alluding to is we don't want to go there. because of the way how the CPI is so bleeped up, because if history is any design, 3 years from now, they actually will have tightened the money supply with all the problems that's going to cause. And oh, by the way, the inflation will be going down, but it's not going to show it's going down. So you end up with things like the COLA really causing the inflation. But I think if they just would have, if they wouldn't have had the timing problem in the CPI and Volcker would have stopped to what he was doing a year earlier, I think we might have saved a good chunk of his savings and loan institution. And oh, by the way, the labor wouldn't be on the hook for all the blame, because they shouldn't have been, because it was what, how many years before they got there? Like now, how could labor be to blame if tomorrow they get a cost of living increase after 12 years of getting it stung where stuck where the sun don't shine, Carl? But they will get the blame.
Well, Chief, but this is the way it always works. Okay, the Fed makes some kind of a change, right, which is driven by what Congress does. If you look at the effective Fed funds rate and you look at the 3-year bond rate, okay, the Fed's got this graph, you go look at it. The market leads in almost every instance. Now there's exceptions, but it's very rare. Normally what ends up happening is the market moves first and the Fed has to move, because I don't care how big the Fed is, it's not big enough to be able to change that. So where does all of that emanate from? It comes from those clowns in D.C.
All right, we got to dash. Here's our topic for this. You and I are talking some history. I think this time, when the market wants to sell these bonds off, that you and I want to set, you know, we want to set the little campfire. That I think they're coming by with essentially, when you say it's like pouring gasoline on the fire. They're pouring a whole barrel in it. They're dousing the fire. You and I look at these numbers this week, and we want to be bond sellers so hard we can taste it. Yeah, what? They're up 4 points. I'm gonna guess, Carl, that with another $20 billion or $40 or $100 billion this week, they just ran over us like a bulldozer.
Because for the time being, that's true. But eventually, you have to stop, because otherwise, the labor side pushes back.
I get it, and we're getting to that point. But somehow, this week's showing we're not there yet.
Well, yeah. Not today.
Take care, buddy. Talk to you next week. S&P futures up 20. NASDAQ futures up 47. Back on Monday. Stacks and Jacks.
Be aggressive. Learn how to push. Talk to him. Ask him questions. Ask him rhetorical questions. Doesn't matter. Anything. Just get a yes out of him. If you're drowning and I throw you a life jacket, would you grab it? Yes. Good. Pick up 200 shares. I won't let you down. Ask him how they'd like to see 30, 40% returns. What are they going to say? No? You? I don't want to see those returns.
Stocks and Jocks is brought to you by PTI Securities and Futures. Go to ptisecurities.com. PTI ProDirect. Trade for as low as a penny per share and a dollar per option contract. Learn more at ptiprodirect.com. Nadex. Offering an intuitive way to trade the financial markets. Visit nadex.com. HomeSource Realty. Call Audrey Johnson at 708-349-3456. Hamzy Analytics. Listen to Fari Hamzy every other Thursday and visit HamzyAnalytics.com. ChiroMed. Back or neck pain? Schedule a complimentary consultation by calling 708-403-2727. DAX Research. Tune in for David Andelman's technical analysis on Mondays and Thursdays and call 1-800-821-4968.